I'm going to kind of jump back into things at the end of 1 Kings 16 there. That's kind of our springboard into Elijah, where we're going to be tonight. We'll just kind of get a running start in with the advent of Ahab, Elijah's great nemesis. And again, one of the most remarkable arcs in all of the Bible, the Elijah and Elisha stories, in which God raises up prophets to match the great wickedness that has arisen in Israel, where Ahab kind of brings at least one round of Solomon's sin that we talked about the first few weeks, kind of brings it to its apotheosis, its climax, and in a tragic way. So, First Corinthians. Listen to me. Wrong side of the canon. 1 Kings 16. Late in Asa's reign, verse 29, in the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah. Let me stop real quick and actually add. Thanks to Randy Tomlinson for filling in. There's the word, man. I am still recovering from last week. Filling in for me last week. Do appreciate Randy so much doing that. But yeah, Asa, 38th year of Asa, Ahab, son of Omri, began to reign over Israel. And Ahab, son of Omri, reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. But what a 22 years they were. By the way, just as a quick sidebar, it's interesting that from archaeology, we hear more about Omri than Ahab, actually. It's kind of interesting. The House of Omri is what it was known in the ancient world. And the idea seems to be, and again, just a reminder of the Bible's view of history versus man's view of history. Archaeologically, we see the House of Omri reference, the number of texts and whatnot that have come down to us from the Assyrian era. They knew about the House of Omri. Omri himself was apparently a fairly powerful and internationally well-known king of the age. In the Bible, though, Omri doesn't matter, because is God concerned about human power and prestige and how well Omri handles his international relationships? No. Why does the Bible tell the story? What's God concerned about? Not about global geopolitics. The Bible's concerned about righteousness and wickedness. And in the Bible's view, Ahab, Omri's son, is a far greater concern because of the level and extent of wickedness that Ahab takes things to. In fact, verse 30 makes it clear, Ahab, son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him, which is saying something, right? And as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sons of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, he took for his wife Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshiped him. Just like we saw, you know, early in the book and mentioned, kind of Solomon sets the tone. Solomon does a lot of the things that others will engage in. What's Ahab's great fall in one sense? The foreign wife once again, who unlike Solomon's wife, Solomon will build, pagan temples. Solomon will worship other gods. But what kind of moves the ball further this time compared to what Solomon did? This wife actually exercises in some ways more authority than Ahab does. So, name me any of Solomon's wives. No. They led his heart astray. He would indulge their paganism, but we don't know their names. They weren't team players. Most of us, I think, are familiar enough with the stories. Who really seems to wear the pants in that house? And we're all nodding. We know who did. Jezebel. Ahab may have been king, but who really seemed to be the driver of it all? Jezebel. And so again, just like in the beginning, what did God say to Adam in Genesis 3 as the consequences of sin were spinning out? Because you listened to the voice of your wife. And what's going on in this part of the story? Once again, like another fall story, who's the one driving the bus? This wicked woman, daughter of Ethbaal, and you hear Baal's name in her dad's own name, right? Because just like, and we forget this sometimes, people's names in the Bible end with Yah, I-A-H, or El. They have God's name in there. So Daniel, Daniel, Hananiah, Isaiah, Jeremiah. Honestly, we don't realize this as much, but we have a lot of our Bible heroes' names. They have God's name in their name. Well, these are pagans. So what's her dad's name? Ethbaal. That's how this works. When you marry Ethbaal's daughter, who moves in with you? Your father-in-law, or at least your father-in-law's God. Baal comes. And so he, verse 32, he erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. And Ahab made an Asherah. And Ahab, again, second time we're told this, did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. In his days, Hiel of Bethel built Jericho. He laid its foundations at the cost of Abiram, his firstborn, and set its gates at the cost of the youngest of Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun. Why is that detail there? All right, well, a couple of things going on here. Number one, what this is referencing, this stuff from the days of Joshua, go with me real quick back to Joshua chapter 6. Little known part of the story, when Israel takes Jericho back originally, in the days of Joshua, Moses' heir, I'm literally at the end of Joshua chapter 6, verse 26. This is what happened in the aftermath of the fall of Jericho. And Joshua laid an oath on them at that time, verse 26, Joshua 6, saying, "Cursed before the Lord be the man who rises up and rebuilds this city of Jericho." So what's going on? Is Jericho supposed to be rebuilt? No. Not only is it not supposed to be rebuilt, but there's a curse laid. Words matter in the Bible. Blessings matter. Cursing matters. Joshua pronounces a curse that is effective, not just his wish or his dream, don't let this ever happen. It's an effective, almost prophetic word, a curse upon any who decides to rebuild Jericho. Now look at what the text says, verse 26. At the cost of his firstborn shall he lay its foundation. At the cost of his youngest son shall he set up its gates. And so what's Kings telling us happened to this guy here named Hiel? And notice, by the way, and notice where Hiel's from. Details matter. Where's Hiel from? Bethel. And why does that raise an eyebrow? And Kings, what do we associate Bethel with? Yeah, golden calves, idolatry, bad stuff. And so you got a guy from a paganized city. And what's the big deal? Why would Joshua, stop and think for a second. Why would Joshua have pronounced a curse upon any effort to rebuild Jericho? Why? I mean, they took other cities, and this doesn't happen. Why Jericho? What's the big deal? Any thoughts? Anyone want to take a stab at it? Go ahead, Nancy.
An angel commander met Joshua beforehand. Mm-hmm. God took those walls down.
That's right. And remember, and now we're getting somewhere. So first of all, you know, we associate it with they walked around the walls, but why do the walls fall? Well, to Nancy's point, in Joshua chapter 5, what or who had Joshua encountered right before they took Jericho? The commander of the army of the hosts of the Lord. In fact, and there's a very famous conversation, are you on their side or their side? And the angel, it seems to be the angel of the Lord himself, actually, you know, says really neither. You know, the better question is who's on my side? That's the better way to frame it. And so, yeah, the whole idea was, and in fact, he says it's a staggering story, and I have come. You know, now I'm here, and the army of God is here. So now the conquest of Canaan can commence. Not because you're here, Joshua, but because the army of God has showed up. And so the marching around was really just the people kind of waiting upon the Lord. You know, how do the walls fall? The army of the Lord. So it's God's conquest. It's God's doing. And related to that, because it is God's conquest, what plunder were the people allowed to take from Jericho? What plunder? Nothing. Why? Why not? Were they allowed to plunder other things that they took? Yes. Why not Jericho? It belongs to God because it is God's conquest. It is the first fruits of the land. Who gets the first fruits? God. And so what did they do with Jericho? What were they supposed to do with Jericho then? What happens to all the gold and the silver? What do they do? Anybody remember Joshua 6? They burn it. That's a great way of taking stuff out of circulation, isn't it? Because who, and in so doing, who does it belong to? Them? I mean, you take it out of circulation, you make it so that it's truly God's. And by the way, that's why Achan had to die, even though he confessed his wrong after he was caught. Why did they have to die? Because he had brought Jericho. He had brought what belongs to God into his tent. So he had to be with his whole family, basically devoted to God as well, devoted to destruction. And so that's the thing is, it belonged to God. It was to be permanently taken out of circulation. And not only that, but it's the first fruits of God's gift of the land to the people, so it belongs to God. But on the other side too, it's a very pagan city, right? What does Rahab say? You know, basically, we're all afraid because we've heard about what your God does. We're pagans. We're not your people. And so it's also this. It is kind of the beginning of the destruction of the Canaanites. Were the Canaanites supposed to be allowed to live in the land any longer? No. Why? And God warns them in Deuteronomy, why don't you let Canaanites stick around? Yeah. And by the way, what has Ahab now done, going back to this whole Jericho motif in the Kings? What is Ahab doing? He's mingling with Canaanites. He's married one. In fact, he's not even the controller. She's going to as much run the kingdom and set the agenda as Ahab is. And so it's taking back what belonged to God, but it's also this. It's the mark of the repaganization of Israel. And this was not to be done. But what's happening in Ahab's own time? The repaganization of Israel. Yes, sir, Dale.
And it's always dangerous when you notice the last verse of Joshua 6. And the Lord was with Joshua.
That's right.
So Joshua cursed the rebuilding of Jericho.
Right. Absolutely. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. This is a prophetic word from Joshua. Don't mess with this. And by the way, the twofold, you notice in Joshua 6 compared to 1 Kings 16 here, the twofold balancing act of the curse. It wasn't just, you know, you rebuild it and people die. Notice how it works. You pay with your firstborn, you pay with your last. It's almost like the wiping out of your line in a sense. And here's the thing too then. The way this curse is pronounced and the way that King says it came to pass exactly the way Joshua warned, cursed it, you know, laid down the curse that it would. You lose your first son when you're laying the foundation. What should you do at this point? The fact that he does not, what does that say about Hiel? What does that say about the attitude of the time? You lose your firstborn son. Oh yeah, I read about this somewhere in my Bible. We shouldn't be here and we shouldn't be doing this. And yet, what does he do? He keeps on. What is it? What's a word for that? Doubling down. That's two words. That's not fair. No, but doubling down. What's a synonym for that? What are other words? I think that's right. What are other words that we can use to heighten doubling down? Arrogant? Defiance. Yeah, anybody else? Clueless, yeah. Yeah, and maybe he really was ignorant. I mean, that's the part of the thing, too, that sometimes the Bible hints at, is that these people don't even, I mean, we'll get to that point in Kings, right, where even Josiah, you know, early in his reign, doesn't know Deuteronomy, doesn't know the law. When they find, you know, the law buried in the temple, they read it and say, oh, we didn't know this stuff. We're in trouble. So, yeah, so it's certainly possibly clues, but maybe he doesn't know. Is that a, say again? Well, yes, and that's what, if I can quit talking so much and we get into the text more, 17, 18, 19, yes, there are a lot of Exodus echoes where now we're back to Pharaoh, we're back to struggling against the let my people go, we're back to being fed in the wilderness for 40 days instead of 40 years. Yeah, there's a lot of Exodus echoes coming. That's exactly right. Yeah, Randy. Yes.
And he sent it. I think he sent his army to establish the fact that he was king.
Right.
And now we see, well, later on, this king now is usurping his authority. And I think that's why he's got so much trouble on his hands.
Right.
He violated the curse.
Right.
Being forth with his sons. But he is trying to take the place of God. And that's what really gets him in a lot of. And that's why I think God says he's done more all the kings before him, because nobody had the audacity to go that far.
Yeah, and to that point, and to Randy's point, if I can summarize everything Randy just said, was just I think it's God was supposed to be king. We saw that in the days of Joshua, and now we're getting to a point here in Kings where you have a guy who's got audacity to go this far, this arrogantly, and so to that, tying that in with Nancy's observation about it, it's kind of got some echoes. Yes, it does. And what happens is when you get a pagan king, and that's a effectively what Ahab has decided to become. He may be ethnically Jewish, but he has clearly allied himself with paganism, outright paganism. The response of God to a pagan king oppressing his people is a prophet, a mighty prophet. When it was Pharaoh in Egypt, who does he send? He sends Moses. And there's going to be some Mosaic echoes in particular. Where does Elijah go later in the story? He goes to Horeb, another name for Sinai. He will say similar things that Moses said. He will see similar things that Moses saw. But the tragedy is, again, now that Israel has become an Egypt for the righteous who are kind of oppressed and held captive. And again, is there an attempt to annihilate all memory of Yahweh and thus his promise, in a sense, just like there was in Egypt? What's Obadiah having to do? Kind of the steward of the house of Ahab. What's Obadiah, though he was a righteous man, what's he having to do with the fact? Just like you hid baby boys from Pharaoh, what's Obadiah doing? Hiding prophets from Jezebel. It's come to that. It's come to just like you're hiding from Pharaoh in the beginning of Exodus, you're hiding from Ahab and Jezebel now, lest the remnant of the righteous be extinguished in the northern kingdom. Isn't that shocking? But that's what it's come to. That's what it's come to. So here's the thing, and so we look at this strong word of condemnation. And again, chapter breaks in awful places, because with this strong paragraph here at the end of 16 saying Ahab has pushed God in a way that nobody else has, and really, and put Jezebel in brackets there, now Elijah the Tishbite of Tishba in Gilead said to Ahab, and here it is, as this mere mortal pushes strong on Yahweh, God pushes back just as strongly with the mightiest prophet we've yet seen in Israel's history. And he said to Ahab, "As Yahweh, the God of Israel, lives before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word." And so it's almost kind of like a plaguish kind of situation. What kinds of powers did Moses wield over Pharaoh's power over nature to kind of wake up Pharaoh that your gods are nothing and so forth? And in particular, no rain. Why does that matter if your main god is Baal? Because what's Baal the god of? Fertility. And in particular, where does fertility come from in an agricultural world? Rain. Yeah, and so Baal is, and we have a lot of ancient Baal legends archaeologically. We have a lot of stories. If we wanted to, we could have an extra night one night, and I'll bring a book out of my library back there, and we'll just read Baal stories for a while. We have a lot of Baal stories from Canaanite archaeology. He is the storm god. He brings the rain. The rain brings the fertility, and the fertility brings life. And so all of these things are in Baal's purview, and that's important. That matters, because as we read the Elijah and the Elisha stories and this great struggle against Baalism in Israel that has been brought, it wasn't new because of Jezebel, but Jezebel promotes it aggressively. Back then, she's the one who, just like today, more and more we feel like we're being pressured to be allies of certain depravity in the workplace or in the school place or whatnot. This was the ancient version of that with Jezebel. You need to be an ally of Baal with Jezebel. It wasn't just around anymore. Now it was expected you were to affirm it. And if you didn't, if you were just one of, worship God alone, you were one of his prophets, you were on the run for your life in these days. It wasn't just Elisha. Obadiah admits, "I'm hiding prophets from her." But God raises up Elijah, who says, God's going to make a fool of your God, your false God, because he's going to show that he has the power over the very things that this Baal is supposed to be the God of. And so the word of the Lord came to him, "Depart from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook Kerit, which is east of the Jordan." East of the Jordan means, where is Elijah going? This is important. If it's east of the Jordan, where is Elijah going now? He's going outside the land, right? Because, you know, when does Joshua come into the land? They cross the Jordan, right? So if you go back east of the Jordan, you're kind of leaving land. Yeah, I know there were the 2.5 tribes over there, but that's kind of symbolically this great significance of you're leaving the land and you're going into the wilderness. Now, when you go out in the wilderness, what should happen to you normally? You should die. You nothing to drink, nothing to eat, right? So Israel's in the land that was supposed to be flowing with milk and honey. Now there's going to be, by God, pronounced by Elijah, a drought. And when comes drought, what follows with drought? Famine, right? Whereas Elijah's going to go out in the desert where you should die of thirst and hunger. And what's going to happen with Elijah? He's going to be fed miraculously just like Israel in the wilderness before. When God sustains life in the wilderness, what's the message of that? This is the God who really does have the power of life and death in his hands. It's not about having, you know, it's not about living in the right zip code, having the best location. No, no. And so he goes out and you drink from the brook. I've commanded the ravens to feed you there. And so he went and did according to the word of the Lord. He went and he lived by the brook Kerit, that is east of the Jordan. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening. And he drank from the brook. Now, after a while, even the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. So now here's what's interesting. Again, geography matters in this part of the story. So we go out in the wilderness first and God makes sure that Elijah doesn't suffer while everybody else is. But God wants the drought and the famine to get worse yet. So now that even Elijah's little brook has dried up, where does he go? The warlord came to him and said, "Arise, go to Zarephath," which belongs to Sidon. Where's that at? It's outside the land. It's up in the north, kind of north of where Galilee would be. But it belongs to Sidon. Why does that matter? Yeah, where's Jezebel from? She's from Sidon. So he's going right into the heart of Jezebel country with her false Baal god. And watch what happens now. We know the story, but the place it happens matters. He goes right into the heart of Jezebel's territory, Baal's territory. "Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you." And so he arose and he went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and said, "Bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink." And as she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, "Bring me a morsel of bread in your hands." And she said, "As Yahweh," and look at the pronouns, "Yahweh, your God." Because what is she? Is she Jewish? No, she's about to become a believer, I think, though. But she's not Jewish. Because he's outside the land. Elijah's gone outside the land. But she knows enough about, apparently already, who Elijah is and what God he represents. That you know, she doesn't quite get the mindset yet. She's still apparently a polytheist. Your God versus my God. But your God seems to be a little stronger than my God. She's going to become a believer here pretty quick. Say again.
God had told her to feed him.
Right. Right. Though there does seem to be this, perhaps this a little bit of... and maybe he did appear to her. That's fair, Dale. Though she admits it, it's almost like Elijah has to walk her a little bit through it. "I have nothing baked, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil of oil in a jug." I can read, yeah. "And now I am gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son that we may eat it and die." And Elijah said to her, "Don't fear, go and do as you've said, but first make me a little cake. Bring it to me, and afterward, make yourself for something for yourself and your son. For thus says Yahweh, God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not be spent, the jug of oil shall not empty until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth." Why is that a big deal? Because until it rains again, are you going to grow any more olives? Are you going to grow any more grain, make any more flour to make meal, to make bread? No. But what's the significance of going straight into the heart of Baal country and saying, even though the drought and the famine continue, your jars aren't going to go empty? What's God saying? I'll provide. And again, what's Baal? He's not a real God. He's nothing. Because I'm going to go in the heart of Baal country and I'm going to feed. And I'm going to feed the widow who's a believer now, certainly. And she went to this, Elijah said, and she and her household ate for many days. The jar of flour was not spent, neither the jug of oil become empty, according to the word that Yahweh spoke by Elijah. But here's the other part of the story then that I want you to think about how this factors into the setting, the idea that we're supposed to be left with here, that, you know, not only is God through Elijah rebuking Ahab directly, but God is literally through Elijah showing God's power over against Baal, and not just in Israel, but outside of Israel as well, even in Baal's own territory. After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill, and his illness was so severe there was no breath left in him. And she said to Elijah, "What have you against me, O man of God? You have come to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son." And he said to her, "Give me your son." And he took him from her arms, carried him into the upper chamber where he lodged, and lay on him on his own bed. And he cried to the Lord, "O Lord my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn by killing her son?" And he stretched himself upon the child three times, and he cried to the Lord, "O Lord my God, let this child's life come into him again." And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah. And the life of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child, brought him down from the upper chamber into the house, and delivered him to his mother. Elijah said, "See, your son lives." And the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord is in your mouth in truth." And by the way, does that remind you of something in the Gospels? Similar story, child dies, Jesus kicks everybody out of the room, raises the child, brings the child back out by the hand. Yeah, Jesus is supposed to be echoing the Elisha things. By the way, does Jesus go up and deal with a widow in the northern country? Yeah, he'll do that too, Luke chapter 7. Yes, ma'am, Kathleen.
Why do you think it says, right, she says, "Have you come to bring remembrance?"
Yeah.
Of
sin.
So
it's
thought of them thinking, like, "Job, you
have
sinned, so
it's
happening to you."
Well, sure. I think that's part of it. And I think the idea is, you know, again, human nature, whenever bad things happen, especially if we have any sensitivity about our own failures, we kind of want to, we want to figure out the reason why. When bad things happen. And so there are two possibilities that most of us fall into. Either we recognize that my life has brought these consequences upon myself, or we don't see our own culpability, and so we blame God. You know, but one way, but the challenge for all of us is we want to make sense of bad things happening. We want to know a reason why. That gives us a sense of control over the uncontrollable. Even if I take the blame, it still gives me a sense of, if I know why this happened, what can I do in the future? I can prevent bad stuff from happening to me by doing what's right. So one of the things that happens when you live in that kind of a thought world where you've gotta have a reason for why something bad happened, which, by the way, biblically, you know, are we always able to figure out a reason why something bad happens? No, that's the mistake. That's the mistake we make. But then, like now, people fall into that system of there's got to be a reason that I can know that this happened. And so in her case, yeah, what happens is when you think about it this way, what she's doing the same thing that Peter does in the Gospels when Jesus, that miraculous catch of fish. Remember, what does Peter do? As soon as they get to shore, he falls down Jesus' feet. What does he say? Yeah, "Depart from me, O Lord, for I am a sinful man." When you're around somebody who works great miracles, and in this case, yeah, he's about to do a greater miracle by raising her son, but you've got this never-ending, emptying pantry in the middle of a famine, you know you're dealing with somebody with great access to great divine power. What does being around somebody who lives really well, and especially somebody who clearly God is with, what does that remind you of about yourself? Just innately. I'm not what I ought to be. I'm not what I should be. When you're around that, I mean, I don't know about you, but I mean, I remember growing up as a kid, you know, a preacher come to town for a meeting or whatever, or just even preachers worshiped with, and you hung around those kind of guys, and maybe you remember some of your childhood memories about older men in the faith you looked up to, and it just made you feel, I mean, you know, there's just almost a holiness about them. You know, we attribute to that, you know, if they knew we thought about them that way, they'd tell us, you know, please, you know, don't put me on a pedestal. But you know what I'm talking about? I remember that. And then I became a preacher, and I was really disappointed with the effects. But yeah, you know, those people that you're around that just kind of elevate you spiritually. You know, so imagine, you know, here's a guy who's not just spiritually in a good place, but he was, remember, because in fact, Elijah's so, it's not just his power, but think about the effect Elijah has. James makes this point, the effect, you know, talking about Elijah in the context of James, the effective fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. And then James's whole point is, look at Elijah and the power of it, not just the miracles he worked, but his prayers, because that's the other thing in this story is, look at every time Elijah talks to God, does God listen? Do things happen? Yeah. And that's James's whole point to us is, this fervency in prayer coupled with a righteous heart and a righteous life, it's effective. So yeah, so you put yourself in that lady's shoes. Even if you're not living a reprobate life, just the sheer fact of being around somebody like Elijah with the kind of holiness that he evokes and the kind of power that he's clearly wielding, you're gonna see yourself in a clearer light too. So she's just trying to, like Peter, realize I'm in the presence of somebody close to God. Yeah. Let me get Randy. I'll come up to Nancy. Yes, sir. Yes, correct.
One, he starts off with a widow who had no way of taking care of herself, and suddenly now she has food for her and her son. But then later, as her son dies, what does God do again? He preserves her again, and so he's demonstrating his power not only of the material things, but also over the spiritual.
Yes. That's right. Thank you for that, because that's part of the chain we didn't get to finish quite drawing. But remember, if Baal is about storm, which leads to rain, which leads to fertility, which leads to life, they are much more aware of the agricultural cycle than we are. Then yes, this also moves the stake further. In the middle of Baal country, now it's not just a matter of the never-ending oil and flour in the midst of a famine. It's literally life and death itself. And by the way, the Canaanites had a god of death. His name was Mot up there as well. And so again, maybe a little stab at him as well as Baal. But yeah, this whole, to your point, way beyond material stuff to literal life and death itself. And so we're really getting into the brass tacks of things. And so Elijah does that. Elisha, who asks for a double portion of Elijah's spirit and gets it, he'll do this as well. And lest we forget this, outside of Jesus, you realize, outside of Jesus, somebody correct me if I'm forgetting a story somewhere, but the best of my recollection, outside of Jesus, these two guys, Elijah and Elisha, are the only ones who raise people from the dead. Can anybody think of, am I forgetting something on that? Because I can't think of any other instance in Scripture outside of Jesus working those types of miracles for the same purpose, no less. So again, the maximalization of God's presence and God's power in this era, in these men, where the caliber of miracle being worked is beyond what we've seen before or what we'll see again until Jesus himself shows up in the days of Elijah, right? I mean, that's the whole point with Malachi saying when Elijah shows back up, the one even greater is about to come. Big stuff going on here. In fact, by the way, and so much power over life and death. One of the other little stories that we're told later on is, Elijah can do this. And by the way, and Elijah never dies. We'll get to that part of the story in due course as well. But then Elisha can do this as well as the one who gets a double portion of Elijah's spirit. But so thoroughly is Elisha invested as well with this kind of power, this divine power, that even when Elisha is dead, remember the story? Anybody remember the story? What happens when somebody's dead body falls on Elisha's bones? Anybody remember the story? The mere remains of Elisha are still so, in one sense, soaked with divine power, whatever you want to, that the dead man comes back to life just from touching Elisha's corpse, which is just a staggering story that raises many questions, including what were you doing with Elisha's corpse? But no. Anyways, yes, ma'am, Nancy.
Kind of picture that this lady as she's learning what God's like from being with Elijah, and instead of having a sense that God came first and saw her and chose her, she sounds like she thinks Elijah brought God.
Yes, yes.
And God might not have noticed her.
Correct.
God would have never met her and figured out, that she had problems and therefore punished her.
No, that's exactly right. I agree, Nancy. I think that's the right reading. I do think that, especially for pagans, the pagan mindset where gods are, associated with, certain places, temples or geography, they're the gods of certain countries or certain peoples, then yes, when one of his people, especially one of his prophets or holy men comes around, I'm literally bringing the gaze of a deity with me. And and I may not want God looking too closely. It's kind of like the IRS today, right? Any of you ever, you're real careful with your tax returns or whatever filings you have to make with the IRS, you just don't give them an excuse to look too closely. Yeah, okay, maybe it's just me. By the way, it is due this week, or due a week from tomorrow, I'm just saying. So yes, if you haven't, they will be looking, folks. They'll be looking for you. No, they're still catching up from last year's returns, so you're fine. No. And they're watching this on the internet. All right. I will file, don't worry. I got a week left. No, anyways. But yeah, that's the whole, but seriously, you know, we don't want to, you know, I remember playing hide and seek as kids, you know, and you're going to make them notice me. So yeah, I think that's right, Nancy. I think that's right. Okay, for sake of time. Yes, I'm sorry. Where am I missing? Oh, Yvette. There you go. Thank you. Absolutely.
And so, why do you get angry? Because there was a condemnation, I don't know, of their faith.
Absolutely.
And so, this widow, let us not just think she believed,
right.
She had something that she believed in God. And I believe the message to us is that if we possess that type of faith in any circumstance, God is saying, I will visit you specifically, and you will have everything that you need at all time while you're here on earth.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. You're right, Yvette. It's interesting that this section, 17, 18, and 19, because Paul will also reference in chapter 19 in the book of Romans, Romans chapter 11, Jesus and the apostles were looking at these stories and subtly making things of them more than we realize. And yes, that's right, Jesus. And the reason that the Jews of Jesus, they are outraged by the meaning Jesus sees in this, where, you know, many widows in Israel, but he goes to this one woman of faith, because God's not supposed to, you know, God's supposed to like us because we're the right kind of people just for our own sake. This whole idea that God loves everybody, even in the Old Testament, by the way, not just once Jesus comes in, the church is meant for Jew and Gentile. It's a scandal that God really, I think, to a lot of us who want God to just like us and people like us, he's a bigger God than that. Yes, sir, Dale.
When Jesus makes the comment, he's also saying something clearly lays him out as divine.
Yeah, fair enough. That's right.
He's looking at history and saying there were many widows in Israel. How does he know that?
Because he was there. Because he was there. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, and again, just the outrage that goes with him suddenly, constantly hinting at his deity. And by the way, you want to talk about bringing God's attention. All right, so for sake of time, because I see it's about 5:46 or so, I think the stories are fairly familiar, especially as we go on now, where Elijah especially has been confessed by a Gentile, by the way, confessed by a Gentile, truly, you are a man of God, and the word of Yahweh in your mouth is true. And that's a big deal, by the way, because later on, Ahab's going to have to choose between false prophets and Elijah's words, and what's Ahab going to do? He's going to go in the battle, listen to the false prophets, and get himself killed is what he's going to do. But the, chapter 18 is the big confrontation where there's a moment of decision then that Ahab and Jezebel have to make. Of course, the text makes clear that the choice is made relatively quickly. The great miracle that we read about here changes nothing, the fire of God from heaven. But for our sake of time, the things that we often miss about this story, you know, this story has a bit of, again, a mix of Exodus motifs. You know, back in Exodus 12, you know, and of course, the story here, in case you haven't read, but you can read it on your own time. For sake of time, I'm not going to read it. You've got the challenge of the prophets, of the false prophets of Baal against Elijah with the altars on Mount Carmel. You know, let's see whose God is really God by responding by responding to us. And you know, and so a couple of the Exodus motifs that are going on here. First of all, you know, back in Exodus 12, when Moses is confronting Pharaoh, back in that era, you know, and granted, he's talking in the context about the tenth plague, the death of the firstborn, but I think it's really meant to apply to everything. For I will, God speaking through Moses says to Pharaoh, I will pass through the land of Egypt that night. I will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, man and beast. And on all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. And so ultimately, it's meant to be seen as, you know, I'm certainly judging Pharaoh for his hardness of heart, his rebellion and sin. But all these gods that you claim to worship in your great civilization, you know, they're nothing. And in what I'm doing, again, I'm showing a power that they don't have. And so that's certainly going on here as well, right? Because you have directly two altars. One altar belongs to God. The other altar belongs to Baal. What's the whole point? You guys do your thing over here. I'll give you as long as you need, so to speak. And then I'm just going to offer a prayer here when all is said and done. And there's my response. But you got the whole day. You cut yourselves. You pour water. You do what you got to do. And of course, the comic relief in the story when Elijah even begins to add his color commentary on what's going on and, you know, offering them suggestions or pointers. Maybe this is why it's not working, etc. Don't you hate those people who do that with computers? You know, just click over here. You know, and that's when you reboot your whole hard drive. No, that's, yeah, God bless the people who know what they're doing with computers when the rest of us don't. And I'm just bitter right now about that because I'm finally getting to that age where I have to ask my kids. And I'm still, it's a new world for me. I'm adjusting. get Abby or Joel to come in and help me with my phone. That's, ugh. Why? That's not funny. I was sharing. So we've got the against the gods motif. The other thing that goes on that comes out of Exodus is you've got Sinai, right? We get to Sinai and other aspects of Sinai that matter. And by the way, where is Elijah going in the very next chapter? He's going back to Sinai. So what do we have? We have an altar at Sinai where they made a covenant with God. Now Elijah constructs a 12-stone altar. What's the symbolism of that? Covenant. These are here God's people. And so we're building as almost a reminder of a covenant on a mountain. What came down from heaven on Sinai? God's presence. And what was God's presence equated with at Sinai? Fire. What's Elijah waiting for God to do? What's God going to send in response to Elijah on the mountaintop? Fire. Right? It's going to burn everything up. Because it's not a natural fire, it's a divine fire. Everything gets burned up. And so you've got presence of God on mountaintop, altar, which we kind of, again, 12-stone altar reminds you of covenant, right? Of covenant. And then the other thing that's going on here as well is, was Sinai also, in a sense, associated with idolatry? Yes, because what happened at the foot of Sinai while Moses is finishing up the covenant details with God at the top of the mountain? What's going on at the bottom of the mountain? Yeah, a golden calf. Yes, sin. A golden calf. And so that's got to be dealt with in judgment. Who, you know, where's God really at in all this? And then the other thing, again, that's tying on between here where we're at and what's happening is especially when we flip the page to chapter 19 where Elijah then in frustration and discouragement goes back to Sinai itself after 40 days in the wilderness, so to speak. He has an encounter with God that looks very much like Moses' response when the people sinned with idolatry in Exodus chapter 33 and 34, right? It's like a whole recycle. Except at that point, and well, here's what's fascinating though, except at this point in the story, again, you read it on your own, connect the dots, Bell's gonna catch us here in a sec. When Moses is in Exodus at Sinai the first time, Exodus 33 and 34, after the golden calf episode, God wants to destroy the people and raise up a nation out of Moses, and what does Moses say to God? Don't do that. Elijah goes to Sinai this time, another great confrontation with the idolatry of the people. And what does Elijah say to God? Basically, I'm done. I've had it. I'm the only one left. You know, we did this great Exodus recapitulation, fire from heaven, mountaintop, altar, covenant, false gods, idolatry. We did the whole thing again. And now Jezebel's saying, I got 24 hours to live, which, you know, obviously he did better than that since it took him 40 days to get to Sinai. But think about it. So now, unlike Moses, what's Elijah basically saying? It's over. It's over. The thing is, though, does God agree in chapter 19, if you've read the story before, does God agree? It's fascinating how the roles have flipped. You know, before it's God talking to Moses saying, let me wipe them out and start over. And now in a sense, it's Elijah this time who's throwing in the towel. And it's God saying to Elijah what?
I still have 7,000.
Yeah. I've still got my people who have not bowed the knee to Baal. And by the way, should Elijah have known that at least in theory? Yeah, because what's Obadiah already told him? I'm hiding prophets. So by the way, just knowing that little bit of the story, a little detail we often forget about, why would Elijah say, I'm the only one left in frustration and disappointment with the God? Why would he say that even knowing intellectually, well, there's other prophets who, like me, would be dead if Jezebel could find them? Why would Elijah then say, I'm the only one left? Why would he say that? Okay. It certainly appears that way. And can you say a little bit more about that window, what you're getting at with that?
Well, it affects him emotionally.
Yes.
It's the constant beating down of everyone around him, laughing and just acknowledging.
Yeah.
Most days, that's what he goes through.
It certainly takes a toll as a human being for Elijah to do that. And I think there's something else you're hinting at there. Let me say this, and I'll get Randy there further back. But here's the thing, too, is who, you know, they exist, and obviously they haven't bowed the knee to Baal, but where are they again? They are. So they're sleeping relatively safe tonight. What's Elijah doing? What's Jezebel said? You got a day, and I'm going to find you and kill you. The frustration of those, you know, there are others out there who do believe and share the faith, but they don't do the work. They don't take the risks. They don't stand up and be counted when it matters. And so, yes, they existed. Elijah intellectually knew they existed, but what were they doing if they were prophets? Hiding in caves. Yeah, Randy.
Another observation about the two stories of Sinai and this one. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, certainly there were the prophets on both sides, and there were the communication that happened and the trash talking that took place.
Yeah.
But in the end, really what God was doing is demonstrating his power to the people that were there witnessing what was going on, because he wanted them to understand who was really God and who was really in control.
Right. Right. And to that end, along with that motif, you know, what's the people's response with the golden calf episode when Moses comes down and confronts them about that? What's the people's response? You know, we've sinned. Go beg God's forgiveness for us, Moses. Whereas what's the response of the people, in a sense, here? Spiritually callous, dead, don't care. You know, just seen one of the great miracles of all the Bible, and so, I mean, again, the change of the people. And so just like Moses has that private audience of God, Elijah had that private audience of God, again, with roles reversed. Before it was Moses, you know, Moses talking God out of destroying the people. Now it's God telling Elijah, get back to work. You know, but what's interesting is, and let's say this real quick before the clock catches us. So God tells Elijah, basically, get back to work. What's God's tasking for Elijah? What does that, you know, at the first go around that Sinai, it's finish the journey to the promised land, right? What does God do or say to Elijah to get him back to work? What are there the kind of three things the text seems to indicate that Elijah's supposed to, per God, leave Sinai and go get back to doing? What are they? Scott, is that your hand?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so Ahab's not going to last. You're worried about them killing you, when the reality is you're going to live to see their successors. So yeah, there's that.
The adversary, Aram, or whatever Syria.
Yes.
The thorn at the yep. Israel side. And then his heir.
Yeah.
His protege,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so, in a threefold, almost like three witnesses, if you will, to the fact that God is still at work in this. And by the way, does God disagree? I mean, yes, there's a 7,000 that haven't bowed the knee to Baal still, but does God disagree with, in a sense, the Elijah's diagnosis of the depravity of the people in the situation as such? No. You know, it's a problem, and that's why we're going to get Jehu. We're going to get a new king. And not just, by the way, and not just a new king, this is important too. It's not just a new king, it's a new dynasty, that this line of Omri, Ahab, and so forth, it's going to be cut off. And you know, next week or two here as we get to that part of the story, and it's a bloody purge too when Jehu comes to town and deals with Ahab's offspring. It won't be Ahab himself, he'll be dead. But and then I'm going to raise up, just like the covenant curses warned for idolatry and breaking the covenant, I'm going to raise up, I'm keeping my word, I'm going to raise up an adversary, Hadad in Syria, and then but I'm going to give you a successor as well, Elisha. You're not alone. You know, you're not the only one. And by the way, what's the significance of giving Elijah a successor? What does that mean? Kind of going back to like what Wyndon was getting at a second, with the emotional toll of it feels like I'm the only one. What's the significance of giving him a successor in that moment? His work was important. That's right. His work was important. It would go on. It matters, and it will go on. What'd you say, Randy? Yes, right. It wasn't over. It's going to go on. Here's the thing. When you're in that I'm the only one left mindset, what you begin to think, if I die or something happens to me, what happens to the cause? It's over. No, Ahab's line's about to be over, but your line, Elijah, and therefore the cause that you serve, the God that you serve, nah, there'll be more. As bad as it looks, as emotionally spent as you are, it will go on. God will not be defeated by these people. And so it will not end with you. And I think that's the reminder we need to have sometimes when we're in our dark moments and I'm the only one left, I'm the only one who cares, I'm the only one who's trying. Those little pity parties we all slip into sometimes, that the spiritual depression that we can be prone to sometimes. Listen, you know, for 2,000 years since Jesus, the people of God have, in some eras and sometimes, suffered greatly, been greatly harassed and persecuted. The world is strong and lured many away. Don't ever think it's going to end in your time or your place, no matter how hard it gets. You may fall away. You may give up. But God won't. And so therefore, all the more, let that actually not be discouragement. Let that be an encouragement to stick with God when you might otherwise give up. Because he doesn't lose. All right, we'll leave it there until next week.